From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. States have been struggling to balance their budgets during this recession. A new study shows that many states are balancing their budgets by slashing programs that help the poor. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Robert Greenstein, director of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which co-sponsored this report. Also today, William Rubenstein of the ACLU discusses a new court decision that brings the legal system one step closer to recognizing the legitimacy of gay and lesbian relationships. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us about some of this year's many incarnations of Santa. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. General Motors has announced a massive cost-cutting program that will result in the eventual closure of 21 plants and the elimination of 24,000 white-collar jobs. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
The cuts are deeper than just about anyone expected. Factories to be idled include 6 assembly plants, 4 powertrain facilities, and 11 parts plants. The shutdowns will take place over the next 4 years. Thousands of blue-collar jobs are at stake. On the white-collar side, the company says that by the mid-1990s, they hope to reduce staffing levels from the current 95,000 down to 71,000 people. The cuts follow pressure being put on the giant automaker by Wall Street, which has long claimed that GM has too many employees, given the company's 35% share of the U.S. passenger car market. Analysts say this is an important step toward improving GM's ability to make a profit. The company could lose as much as $8 billion in North America this year alone. GM stock is trading at a 4-year low. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Ameritech announced today that it would eliminate 4,300 jobs at its Bell Telephone subsidiaries in the Midwest. The company said it plans to take a $140 million after-tax charge in the fourth quarter to pay for the reductions and other cost-cutting measures. Ameritech now has more than 75,000 employees. The company said it will cut its management force by 2,000 by the end of the year, including some workers who took advantage of a voluntary retirement program. Ameritech said the remaining 2,300 jobs will be eliminated nationwide over the next several years. The latest round of Middle East peace talks has ended in Washington, D.C., with little progress made on the issues that divide Israel and its Arab neighbors, but all have agreed to resume negotiations next month. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Israeli and Palestinian negotiators never did get out of the State Department corridor and into the negotiating room, blocked by a dispute over how prominent a role the Palestinians should play in the talks. Palestinian spokesperson Hanan Ashrawi said her delegation had demonstrated its commitment to peace and added,
I feel we have gotten through to American public opinion. We have had meetings, also I've had meetings with senators and congressmen on the Hill.
Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli spokesperson, noted that the Israeli-Syrian talks and the Israeli-Lebanese talks had dealt with substantive issues, and that Israeli and Palestinian negotiators had become better acquainted with each other and with each other's positions.
In all cases, I think we're well ahead of where we were a few weeks ago in Madrid.
There's been no decision on a location for the January round of talks. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 6 points to finish the day at 2,908. Declines edged advances in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 192 million shares. This is NPR News. The British government said today that it's begun a formal fraud investigation into the financial dealings of the late media tycoon Robert Maxwell. The Serious Fraud Office said it set up a team of lawyers, accountants, and police to probe allegations that Maxwell ran an illegal operation to prop up the value of shares in his major corporation. In a separate investigation, a London forensic expert examined tissue from Maxwell's corpse in an effort to determine how the flamboyant publisher died. Maxwell's body was found in the waters off the Canary Islands after an apparent fall from his yacht. Representatives of the United Nations and the European Community have arrived in Yugoslavia, but their presence hasn't calmed the fighting in Croatia. The Serbian-led Yugoslav army is maintaining its land and air bombardment of the eastern city of Osijek. Pierre Vickery reports at least 5 civilians have been killed.
The European Community mediator, Lord Carrington, held talks in the Austrian town of Graz with the Slovene and Croatian presidents. before flying on to Serbia to meet the leaders of the other four Yugoslav republics. The European Community has set a deadline of Monday for individual republics to decide whether they wish to be recognized as independent states. At the same time, an advance party of United Nations civilian and military officials has arrived in Belgrade to examine the possibility of sending a peacekeeping force to Yugoslavia if the heavy fighting reported from most Croatian battlefields is halted. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Federal narcotics agents said that they seized an estimated 3 tons of cocaine in a raid on a Miami warehouse today. The drugs were reportedly concealed inside concrete fence posts that were imported from Venezuela. Agents from the Drug Enforcement Administration say the raid is part of an ongoing investigation that's already resulted in the second largest seizure of drugs in U.S. history. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been a rough year for working people who lost their jobs, and it's been a year when the have-nots have had even less than they had before. A new study shows that many states tried to balance their budgets in 1991 by slashing programs that assist the poor. My guest is Robert Greenstein, director of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which specializes in analyzing data and policy issues affecting low- and moderate-income Americans. This group, in conjunction with the Center for the Study of the States, released a report earlier today analyzing how poor people fared as the states desperately tried to balance their budget during this year's recession.
Well, one of the striking findings of the report is that different states that faced very large budget deficits took different courses. Some states largely or partially shielded the poor. Other states subjected the poor to deeper cuts than anybody else. The deepest cuts of any state in programs for the poor came in Michigan, but we identified 8 states overall that were the deepest. Michigan at the deepest level, Massachusetts second deepest, but also California, Maryland, Ohio, Illinois, Maine, and the District of Columbia. All of these 8 jurisdictions cut deeply into both cash assistance programs and other areas of support for the poor at the same time. Many of these states were characterized by simultaneously making deep cuts in cash assistance programs for people that don't get any other cash aid, that have no other income, and where these cuts would place them at some increased risk of homelessness, and then cutting programs to avert homelessness or to help the homeless at the same time. Several of these states also raised taxes more on the poor than on any other group at the same time that they were cutting fairly severely into their basic benefits.
Well, you say that Michigan had the worst cutbacks. Michigan ended general assistance.
Michigan did several things. Michigan terminated its general assistance program. This is a cash assistance program for indigent people who are not eligible for any other form of cash aid from any level of government, federal, state, or local. Michigan took more than 82,000 people who received cash aid from this program and simply terminated them. These are, by and large, people who have now no cash income at all. Michigan, at the same time that it terminated their cash assistance, terminated medical assistance, health care coverage for all 82,000 people at the same time. But that wasn't all that Michigan did. It cut AFDC benefits, that's the basic public assistance program for poor children and their families. It cut benefits in that program by more than an eighth. It also eliminated additional payments that used to go to pregnant women who were on AFDC, as well as additional payments to people facing high heating bills during the winter. And it took the state payment for the elderly and disabled poor that's a supplement to the federal basic benefit for the elderly and disabled poor. The federal benefit lives people below the poverty line, so over half of the states supplement it. Michigan took its state payment for the elderly and disabled poor, cut it more than 50%. It also terminated all state funding for the WIC program, the nutrition program for women, infants, and children that's been found to reduce infant mortality and low birth weight. Michigan also made substantial cuts in emergency assistance programs designed to reduce or avert homelessness and to help people avoid utility cutoffs or eviction. Now, Michigan did all of this at the same time that the unemployment rate in the state is 9%. There are several hundred thousand unemployed workers in the state, and the likelihood that people on these programs, who tend to be less educated and skilled, could find jobs when more skilled, formerly middle-class workers who've been laid off can't, is a fairly slim possibility.
Do you know what the rationale was for cutting back on welfare programs in Michigan to balance the budget?
Well, Michigan was one of the states, there were many this year, that faced very severe budget problems. Now, in Michigan, the governor is an extremely conservative governor. Was adamantly opposed to any tax increase at all. There were some states that didn't raise taxes on middle-income people but raised them some on the richest people in the state. Michigan did not raise taxes on anybody, and other large parts of the budget were put off limits from any cuts. And basically, these were proposals the governor made in the deepest cut, the termination of all aid for 82,000 indigent people. The governor argued throughout the year that these were people who were able-bodied and they ought to be able to go to work. For those people, this is really all they could get. And the idea, again, that they would be likely to get jobs in a state with a 9% unemployment rate was pretty slim. But that is the major rationale the governor has used, that the state couldn't afford it, that these people were able-bodied and they should just go out there and work.
So do you think that other states will be looking to the states who made the most drastic cuts, like Michigan, to see if they might do the same thing next year?
Yes, just in the, you know, one of the things that's happened is that states that thought they had balanced their budget for the 92 fiscal year, that year usually runs July 1 to June 30th, most of those states followed, to some degree, the projections that the Bush administration was putting out at that time, that within a few months the economy would be in a recovery. The economy is not in a recovery, and as a result of that, state revenue collections are lower than projected in many states because their economy is weaker than projected. This means that many states that thought they had balanced their budgets last summer now find they're not balanced after all. And in the past several weeks, Governor McKernan in Maine has proposed following Michigan's example and terminating general assistance there. Governor Schaefer in Maryland has proposed following a good way towards the Michigan example and terminating, throwing half the people on the general assistance program, terminating all benefits for them in Maryland. And in several other states, similar proposals are now being advanced.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Greenstein. He directs the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which specializes in analyzing data and policy issues affecting low- and moderate-income Americans. They've just released a study on how state budgets were balanced at the expense of the poor. Why are states being forced to take such draconian measures? What kind of economic issues are impacting on the state budgets now?
State budgets are in very tough shape, no question about it. They are in much tougher shape than they were even during the 81-82 recession. There are several reasons for this. First, there are two areas where state costs are rising rapidly. One is in the area of health care. As I'm sure most listeners know, health care costs are going through the roof. If you're a small employer, your premiums may be going up 20% per year. State governments face rapidly rising health care costs both for Medicaid, in which states pay up to half of the cost. That's the health care program for poor families with children and for elderly and disabled poor people. They also face rising health care costs for health care premiums for state employees and for other health services the state helps support. Secondly, corrections costs, in other words, prisons. Prison costs are rising very rapidly in most states across the country as the number of people incarcerated continues to mount. In addition to that, school enrollments are now rising in many states. We went through a baby bust period but now the birth rates are going back up some. So states are simultaneously facing large increased costs for health care and prisons, significant increased costs for education, at the same time that their revenues are not keeping pace, because in part because of the recession, and in part because of state tax systems. Many state tax systems, most state tax systems, in fact, are somewhat archaic. They are somewhat archaic because many states rely very heavily on sales tax and to a lesser degree on the income tax. And the sales tax is primarily a tax on goods, but our economy is increasingly an economy of services as well as goods, and most services aren't subject to the sales tax. That means that over time, a smaller proportion of state economic activity is subject to the sales tax, and the sales tax revenues don't rise along with the economy. So you have all of these things going on that are putting a crimp in state budgets.
What about the federal cutbacks of the early 1980s under President Reagan? How did those cutbacks end up affecting state budgets?
Well, a big part of the story is what the federal government did. In doing this study, in fact, we looked at federal grants to state and local government, other than grants that are really just entitlements passed through to individuals. When you look at federal grants to state and local governments, in fiscal year 91, they were 34% lower than in fiscal year 81. In other words, federal funding for state programs has been cut a third. That is a very large cut. When you talk of who got hit the hardest in the federal budget cuts of the 80s, and we often think of, was it the unemployment program? Was it job training programs? If you think of it in terms of governmental entities, state and local governments were perhaps the entities hit harder than any other in our nation by those cuts. And so part of what happened was that benefits and services were already reduced, including benefits and services for the poor. And some state taxes were already raised as states attempted to fill the gap for some of the federal cuts. In 1990, the other shoe dropped. The economy stopped growing. Many of us believe that the recovery of the 80s was fueled in part by very large federal budget deficits anyway, and that it was something that couldn't last. The other shoe dropped. The economy sunk into recession. The federal money didn't come back, but states had trouble continuing to afford some of the steps they took to ameliorate the most severe aspects of the federal withdrawal. So that's part of the picture as well. If it's not a good time to be a governor or a state legislator, but I do think it's interesting that not all states cut programs for the poor this year. Some states that faced very deep deficits largely shielded the poorest people in our country. This really is a matter where states can make choices.
Do you think it necessarily follows that if general assistance programs are cut, that more people are going to end up living on the streets?
I do think that's likely. Most people on general assistance do not qualify for any other form of cash assistance from any level of government, federal, state, or local. Many of them have no other source of income. If they don't have a general assistance, they can't pay the rent. Many of those on general assistance actually already rent rooms for 2 or 3 weeks of the month and are homeless for the other week or two because their payment is so low, it doesn't cover the rent. So I'm not saying everyone who's cut off will end up on the streets, but I think it's likely a significant proportion will. And studies of past cuts in general assistance in states that have done these cuts before confirm that.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Robert Greenstein. He's the director of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And they've just released a study analyzing how 50 states balance their budget for fiscal 92 by cutting programs for the poor. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Greenstein, and he directs the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which specializes in analyzing policy issues affecting low and moderate income Americans. I want to ask you a little bit more about what you think the motives are for states who are cutting programs that help the poor. Do you think that there's heartlessness behind it, or just pure practical need to cut more money out of the budget, and that's something that can be cut?
I think there's a lot of politics here. Cash aid programs for the poor, the programs that were cut most deeply this year, constitute only 5% of state budgets nationwide. If you take all cash assistance programs for the poor combined, I think there are only four states in the country where they constitute more than 6% of the budget. So states do have other options. However, many of the other options involve taking on powerful interest groups, and the people in these programs are the weakest political constituency in the country. They're not organized, they make no campaign contributions, and most of them don't vote. They are, in a tight budget time, the easiest people to cut.
Your report does praise some states for shielding the poor from budget cuts. Can you give us some example of a couple of states that you think shielded the poor?
Well, one example would be Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania faced a budget that was as large as a percentage of its deficit as many of the states that made the deepest cuts. Pennsylvania had a deficit equal to about a fifth of its budget. It really didn't cut any of the major programs for the poor. It actually expanded some of the health programs. For example, it increased state funding for the nutrition program for poor pregnant women, infants, and children. That's a program that reduces low birth weight and infant mortality. Pennsylvania, in raising taxes, did raise some taxes that are regressive. Regressive taxes take a larger percentage of income from the poor than from people at high income levels. But Pennsylvania accompanied that with some low-income tax relief. Two other states that come to mind are Texas and Vermont. Now, Vermont did make some cuts in programs for the poor, but the New England states were in tough shape. And when you compare Vermont to Massachusetts and Maine, you see that Massachusetts and Maine made much more severe cuts in programs for the poor than Vermont did. Similarly, Texas had a large budget deficit. And while the taxes that it raised were regressive and hit the poor harder than other groups, it really shielded the basic assistance programs for the poor in a way that many northern states did not do.
If you were president, or if you were the governor of a large state, what are some of the things you would be recommending to balance state budgets?
Well, one of the things that I think I would do is I would look at both the spending side and the tax side. And on the tax side, I would particularly look at two areas. I would look at some increase in income taxes on the rich. There were five or six states, by and large states that did not do deep cuts in programs for the poor, that raised income taxes on people over $100 or $150 or in some cases $200,000 a year of income this year. I think that's something more states should look at. That group is the group that got the bulk of the gains in the American economy over the 80s, and they can afford a modest tax increase at a time that's very rough for other Americans. I would also look at tax loopholes. Most states still have a significant number of unproductive tax loopholes. Some of them are corporate tax loopholes. Some of them are upper income tax loopholes. And closing those is an alternative to look at.
Let me ask you, how much faith do you have right now in our elected leaders to turn around the economy?
Not a great deal. I think we do need to distinguish carefully between taking actions that help the economy to grow in the long run and taking action to pull ourselves out of the recession in the short run. When you have a $350 billion deficit as a result of a decade of fiscal mismanagement, it limits your options on what you can do to lift the economy out of recession in the short run. I mean, I would favor not only shifting money from defense to domestic, but doing it in a way where over a five-year period, every dollar you have put in domestic is paid for by a dollar taken out of defense. But I wouldn't pay for it year by year. I'd put more into domestic than I was taking out of defense right now to stimulate the economy. And 3 years from now, I would do it the reverse. I would have more coming out of defense than going into domestic. So I got deficit reduction by 3 years from now when the economy should be stronger. But I fear that what the Congress and the president are going to do instead is a new raft of tax loopholes and upper income tax breaks. All the signals here in Washington are that we're going to get a bidding war on a new round of tax cuts, not dissimilar from those we got in 81, that these will be tax cuts, that a series of gimmicks will be used to make it look like they pay for themselves, but that in the long run, increase the deficit and dig the economy into a deeper hole, and that confer larger benefits on the wealthy through a new set of loopholes that are presented as promoting growth, but where most economists think they don't promote growth, like capital gains cuts, individual retirement accounts, real estate tax shelters, and the like. That's not where the money should be going. So I am pessimistic about what the federal government will do. My fear is the federal government will make things worse rather than better. I sincerely hope I am wrong on that score.
If you could make one recommendation to Congress, what would it be?
I think my recommendation to Congress would be to fully pay for any middle-income tax cut through upper-income tax increases and to take defense savings, make as significant savings in defense as we can, consistent with national security, and invest those in rebuilding our economy and our country.
Robert Greenstein, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Robert Greenstein directs the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, D.C. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Gay and lesbian relationships are often not recognized by the state. Yesterday, a court in Minnesota recognized the legitimacy of a lesbian relationship by granting a woman guardianship of her lover. Gay rights activists say it's a very important precedent. Coming up, we talk about why with William Rubenstein, the director of the ACLU's Lesbian and Gay Rights Project. And with only 1 week left to Christmas, there are Santas on TV wherever you turn. TV critic David Bianculli tells us about some of his Santa sightings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In a severe cost-cutting move, General Motors has announced plans to close 21 plants in North America and cut thousands of jobs. GM will speed up a white-collar job-cutting program that has done away with 6,000 jobs this year and add to it 9,400 jobs next year. GM also plans to cut its hourly workforce by 15,000 people next year. GM assembly plant closings are expected to affect supplier plants, thus adding to the number of overall layoffs. In addition, there will be a 2-week closing of North American operations in July. President Bush flew to Dallas, Texas today to sign into law a new transportation bill designed to upgrade the nation's highway system. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The new transportation law will cost about $151 billion and will create 600,000 jobs, according to the president.
We pursued this law because it moves us closer to our three top domestic priorities: jobs, jobs, and jobs.
Meanwhile, the administration was floating the idea of a $300 tax rebate to every taxpayer next year to spur consumer spending and get the economy moving again. But the idea was shot down by House Republican leaders who called it a gimmick, and Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan warned Congress not to adopt any quick-fix measure that would add to the $360 billion federal deficit. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Also in Washington, the U.S. Department of Defense has announced that it is sending in 300,000 pounds of surplus food from the Persian Gulf War to Moscow and St. Petersburg. NPR's Ann Gerrels reports.
The food shipments scheduled to arrive later this week include milk, sugar, shortening, flour, rice, and potatoes, plus a range of packaged meals. The food will be distributed by U.S. Embassy officials and local authorities to schools, hospitals, and other charitable organizations. The administration has set aside another $165 million for emergency food aid, which is yet to be delivered. One reason for the delay is concern over distribution. There are numerous Soviet reports that goods donated from abroad are making their way onto the black market. Earlier this week, the U.S. and Soviet militaries jointly airlifted in $6 million worth of donated medical aid. This was coordinated by Project Hope, which has now distributed $26 million worth of basic medical supplies over the past year. Project Hope has made elaborate arrangements to keep theft of the supplies to a minimum. I'm Ann Gerrels in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 6 points to close at 2,981.09 on volume of 192 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 9-7. This is NPR News. Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan has warned Congress against any speedy moves to help the U.S. economy in spite of what he calls faltering business activity. Testifying today on Capitol Hill, Greenspan said it is now apparent that the U.S. economy is struggling, and he blamed present problems on the huge buildup of debt during the 1980s by both consumers and business. Greenspan said that a slow recovery that began in the spring faltered when both business and consumers, concerned about the future, decided to cut down on old debts rather than to invest. As South Africa prepares for long-awaited constitutional talks, one of the nation's major black leaders says that he will not be there. Mangosuthu Buthelezi, head of the Inkatha Freedom Party, says he will not lead his delegation. NPR's Renee Montaigne reports.
the Inkatha leader had demanded that his homeland of KwaZulu be represented not only by Inkatha, but by two extra delegations, one from the KwaZulu government and one from the Zulu king. At a rally before thousands of followers, Buthelezi insisted that unless KwaZulu was allowed all three delegations, he would not show up. This week, the other participants in the talks, including the ANC, the South African government, and other homeland parties, turned Buthelezi down. Buthelezi's absence does not mean that the Inkatha Freedom Party will not participate. The IFP is considered to be one of the most critical players in the talks, known as the Convention for a Democratic South Africa, or CODESA. And since the two-day meeting, which begins this Friday, is just the beginning of constitutional negotiations, there will be plenty of chances for the Inkatha leader to step back in and resume his leadership of the Inkatha delegation. From Johannesburg, I'm Renee Montaigne.
In trading today in Europe, the U.S. dollar was mixed against other foreign currencies. Gold prices moved up. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Yesterday, the legal system moved a step closer to recognizing the legitimacy of gay and lesbian relationships. A Minnesota appeals court granted guardianship of 35-year-old Sharon Kowalski to her lesbian lover, Karen Thompson. The case dates back to 1983, when Kowalski was in a car accident that left her nearly paralyzed with short-term memory loss and impaired speech. Her lover, Karen Thompson, wanted to be Kowalski's guardian, but Kowalski's parents objected. They said their daughter never told them she was a lesbian. Sharon Kowalski's father was appointed caretaker by a district court in Minnesota, and he barred Thompson from visiting his daughter for several years. Last year, the father resigned his guardianship, and the judge appointed a third party to take care of Kowalski. Yesterday, that decision was overturned by a Minnesota Court of Appeals. The judge said that all the medical testimony established that Sharon Kowalski has the capacity to express a preference in this case, and she has clearly chosen to return home with Thompson. William Rubenstein is the director of the ACLU's Lesbian and Gay Rights Project. I asked him about the significance of this decision.
The importance of the court's decision in the Kowalski case may, in some larger picture, be more important as a societal matter than as a legal matter. As a legal matter, it sets a precedent that a lesbian or gay partner can be, and in fact should be, appointed to be the guardian of their partner in these kinds of circumstances. But it is an intermediate appellate decision from a Minnesota court, so the legal stature of it nationwide is somewhat... it's not a United States Supreme Court decision. Nonetheless, it's the first decision of its kind like this, so it's very important in that sense. And it clearly lays out all of the reasons that a lesbian or gay partner should be recognized as a guardian where they've taken care of their partner and are clearly the best person to do it. So it's a very good opinion, and it's a very well-written opinion, and it will be authoritative in that it's the first written opinion of its kind on this issue. But I think the decision coming as it does has a larger significance than its legal significance. I think societally it's a terribly important decision because it overcomes years and years of homophobia in the court system and recognizes the reality of lesbian and gay family life for the first time in this case.
I think there's something of a catch-22 in lesbian and gay relationships. Certain rights that spouses would have, lesbian and gays don't have because they're not married. On the other hand, the state doesn't allow them to get married.
Yeah, that's completely correct. I mean, lesbian and gay relationships, I mean, you kind of were caught coming and going. On the one hand, we're not permitted to get married, so that all of the rights that go with marriage, all of the kind of automatic things that flow from being married, do not go to lesbian and gay relationships, and we kind of have to fight for each one of them on a case-by-case basis. Then when we go into court to fight for them, the first thing that people say is, well, you're not married. And the fact of the matter is, we can't get married. So it is somewhat of a catch-22 situation. I think that people tend to overlook how much of our society is built around the rights that follow from a marriage, and that when you don't have the legal right to get married, how many benefits are denied to you. The importance of the Kowalski case, in some sense, is that it highlighted a very good example and a tragic example of why we need legal recognition for lesbian and gay relationships. Had Sharon and Karen been married, or had they been a married couple, their right to have this guardianship appointment would have been automatic. There wouldn't have been this 8-year struggle, 7 years in the Minnesota court system. I mean, 7 years in the court system fighting simply for the right to take care of one another and have that right recognized by law, where if they had been a heterosexual couple or a married couple, it would have been automatic in that sense. I think that there's perhaps no better example of the reasons that lesbian gay relationships need to be recognized by the law.
Now, Thompson and Kowalski had exchanged rings at a commitment ceremony. Do the courts recognize that at all?
Well, again, with regard to fighting for lesbian and gay relationships, you're kind of put in a case-by-case basis of going into court in different kinds of circumstances and arguing about whether the relationship should be recognized or not. And when you're in front of a judge arguing about whether the relationship should be recognized or not, anything that you can point to that is kind of objective evidence of the relationship is very, very helpful. So in this case, the fact that they had exchanged rings, the fact that they had recognized each other as insurance beneficiaries were both recognized by the court. The court took notice of those facts as proving the existence of this relationship. And without any other mechanism to prove it, these kind of extrajudicial mechanisms become very important. We did a case here in New York State that went to the highest court in New York, the New York Court of Appeals, the Brashi case, which involved the right of a surviving partner to remain in a rent-controlled apartment. And family members were allowed to remain in rent-controlled apartments, and we had to prove that a gay man was a family member of his lover who had died. And similarly, in that case, we had to put in front of the court all the indicia of family to show that these two men were really a family of one another. And they included these kind of things, exchanging rings, shared bank accounts, family photographs, holding themselves out to a family. So in each case, there's an incredible burden of going in on a case-by-case basis and putting forward all of the facts of your existence. And, you know, as a lawyer, you hope that your clients have these facts to show. But oftentimes they don't. And particularly, I think, lower-income and lower-middle-income people may not have the kind of objective criteria that courts are most comfortable with, things like shared bank accounts or credit cards.
My guest is William Rubenstein, the director of the ACLU's Lesbian and Gay Rights Project. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is William Rubenstein, who directs the ACLU's Gay and Lesbian Rights Project. One of the complications for a lot of gays and lesbians who are involved in long-term relationships with somebody is that the parents of one of the two might really oppose the sexual orientation. And I think this was an issue in the Kowalski case. Kowalski's father didn't approve of the lesbian relationship, and when he had temporarily won custody, one guardianship of Kowalski, he prohibited Kowalski's lover from even visiting her.
Yeah, that's entirely correct. I mean, really, what the Kowalski case comes down to is the fight between between Sharon's partner in her lesbian relationship and her natural family. And I think what this exemplifies is kind of the extremes to which a natural family might go to try to deny the fact that their daughter was a lesbian and was in this kind of relationship. It's really an extraordinarily extreme case in that sense. Not only that Mr. Kowalski, you know, has fought in the court system for so long, but that, as you point out, at a certain point in the case, he absolutely cut off all visitation between Sharon and Karen, which is really rather extraordinary. Again, this resonates for a lot of gay people with the AIDS crisis as well. Well, this has come up more often in the 80s probably than any time before, with so many gay men dying of AIDS. A lot of their partners are often in disputes, or sometimes in disputes with surviving family members, over issues that range from who might take money from the estate to something quite simple like who's going to take care of the funeral and where are the remains going to be buried. You know, I've heard incredibly horrific stories about a dead gay man's partner fighting with his natural family about the very remains of the body itself.
Why did it take 7 years in the legal system for this case to be resolved?
this case essentially was resolved early in the 80s if you look at it in terms of the resolution to the Kowalski family. The important thing about this case is that Karen never gave up, that she continued fighting for 8 years. And really what she's been fighting for 8 years is the homophobia of our society, in particular the homophobia and the failure to recognize lesbian and gay relationships by the Minnesota court system. What's amazing about this case is that Karen persisted over those 8 years and kept going back and going back and going back and finding ways. I mean, one of the really, really amazing things to me about this case is so often you hear people in our society belittle lesbian and gay relationships. And I think if you look at what Karen's done for the last 8 years to win the right to take care of her permanently disabled partner, I don't think there's a better testament to what a relationship is or what a lesbian and gay relationship can be than what Karen Thompson has been doing for 8 years. It's really extremely extraordinary.
Karen Thompson won on the appellate appeal. Now, for the next person who's in a gay or lesbian relationship and who, you know, has gone through the commitment ceremony and the ring and everything, and who wants the same kind of rights that Karen Thompson won in the appeal, will they have to take it to the courts too, and will the appeal necessarily apply? Will this precedent necessarily apply?
Yeah, good question. Guardianships can be appointed in any number of ways, and if they're not contested, they often don't have to go through the court system in quite this way. If they won't end up being a legal battle unless they arise in a context of a contest like this one between the natural family and the lesbian or gay partner. If they arise in that context in Minnesota, this case would be a direct precedent that you could cite and would probably be controlling, or you could argue that it would be controlling. So it's very important in that sense. If they arise in the context of a contest in another state, this Minnesota decision wouldn't necessarily be controlling, but it would be very persuasive precedent that you could argue about in any other state and hold up as good precedent.
For anybody who's in a long-term relationship, would you advise a commitment ceremony and exchanging rings? So if there is in the future a guardianship type of question, there will be some kind of tangible evidence that you could present in court to prove your commitment to each other.
I think actually that the ceremony question is a very personal one. I think anyone who's in a relationship has to decide whether they would want to have a ceremony or exchange rings or have some kind of religious ceremony or whatever based on their own personal beliefs. I think if people are not, for instance, comfortable with ceremony and that's not the route that they want to go, they can execute legal documents that would have the same effect, the same kind of argumentative effect if they were ever to end up in court in this type of situation.
What kind of legal documents?
Well, for instance, with respect to a guardianship, you can execute either a power of attorney or a living will, the same kind of legal documents anyone else would execute. You can execute them while you're healthy and designate someone either to take care of you in this situation if this kind of thing happens or to make decisions for you if you're incapable of making them. Generally speaking, those documents, if they're properly executed at a time when you're of sound mind and body, will be followed by the court system. It is true that the courts may be loath to follow them if you've designated a lesbian or gay partner to take those to make those decisions for you or to take care of you. But by and large, the existence of a good written binding document like that will hold up in court in today's world in most places.
Do you think that homophobia within the judicial system has been a barrier to getting civil liberties for gays and lesbians?
I think homophobia in the judicial system is an enormous barrier to lesbian and gay rights every single day. I think in almost every area in which we fight for our rights in the courts, we come up against it. When you think about it, societal attitudes towards lesbians and gay men are changing, and to some extent that's reflected in the judiciary. But judges are people themselves, and if you take a poll of the public and 60% like something or don't like something, chances are 60% of the judiciary like something or don't like something along the same lines. Judges are people, and despite our legal system's belief that we law is above men or women or whatever, it's not the case. The law is made by judges, and judges are people. And with the current federal judiciary, they're increasingly conservative people as well, so the fight's even harder all the time. I think you can go through different areas in the law and the current legal status of lesbians and gay men, and you can see what we're up against. There was a recent opinion in a military case in the District of Columbia involving Joe Steffen, who was kicked out of the Naval Academy just some few months before he was to graduate at the very top of his class, kicked out solely on the basis of his homosexuality. And a federal district court judge in Washington, in an absolutely horrific decision, has recently upheld the military's right to kick Joe out in those circumstances and upheld the military's regulations which prohibit lesbians and gay men from serving their country in the military. And, you know, I think Judge Gash's opinion in this case is a good example of what we're up against. He totally discounts the Equal Protection Clause applicability to lesbians and gay men. And basically, the bottom line of his opinion is that the Constitution and the Equal Protection Clause are not out there to protect our rights.
So what are the other big civil liberties issues now on the gay and lesbian rights front?
Well, I, as I said, I think that the emergence of family issues is really, in some ways, at the center of the lesbian and gay rights agenda and the fight for equal recognition of our relationships, both in cases like the Kowalski case and also increasingly with benefits issues in the workplace. I think lesbians and gay men are increasingly fighting for equal benefits rights in the workplace. Second, I think the military issue continues to be near the top of the agenda, and more broadly, I think discriminatory policies beyond the military itself. There's still state governments which refuse to hire and fire lesbians and gay men, and all kinds of policies that we're fighting both in the state and in private workplaces. I think a third issue is, believe it or not, still sodomy laws, which are on the books still in half the states in the United States. And I think much of the lesbian and gay rights movement is also, of course, because of the AIDS crisis and other events, geared toward fighting AIDS and in a larger picture toward fighting for health care benefits and access to health care for all people.
William Rubenstein is the director of the ACLU's Lesbian and Gay Rights Project. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll have the news tonight. Also, Robert Siegel talks with Robert Kerry, the senator from Nebraska, about his Democratic campaign for the presidency. I'll have a story about sexual harassment at the Bath Iron Works in Maine. The state of Maine has a sexual harassment law. The Bath Iron Works has a firm policy in place, but the Union Human Rights Committee wants the company to take an even stronger position. We'll hear about groping on the job and lewd language, even women pursuing men. Also, we'll hear about the good old days in the shipyards. During World War II, a couple who met on the job, and the man says the Code of the West was then in effect.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Each December brings a new crop of TV specials and series with holiday themes, even though, as TV critic David Bianculli says, there are more than enough already.
For the first 11 months of the year, most of us seem to have a pretty good grip on reality, except for the occasional sightings of Elvis or a UFO, or Elvis in a UFO. But in December, on TV anyway, it's hard to turn around or turn the channel without bumping into another Santa Claus. And I'm not talking about a department store Santa with a heart of gold or a badly animated puppet Santa running around on some dumb tabletop. I'm talking about Saint Nick himself, who's clocking more TV guest appearances this season than Macaulay Culkin. Just a couple of days ago, Lloyd Bridges played the real Saint Nick in an NBC telemovie called In the Nick of Time. Because of what you might call a clause in his contract, Saint Nick had to turn over the reins and the reindeer to a new Santa, who turned out to be Michael Tucker, playing a newspaper columnist with a heart of gold. Talk about your endangered species. Anyway, tonight on CBS, there's another Santa sighting. It comes at the end of the first Bloom County TV special, after Opus the Penguin has spent most of the show complaining about his wings. Opus can't fly, but he can swim in cold water, which helps him rescue Santa Claus from an Arctic ice floe. Afterward, Santa says thanks.
You seem to have mislaid your hat from your head. I would be honored to have you wear mine instead.
It's designed as a sentimental moment, but this ice flow scene actually goes against the flow of the rest of the rather sarcastic show. The Santa appearance seems to come from nowhere and doesn't match the established tone. For that matter, the whole special is pretty disappointing. No magnum opus. But for a Santa appearance out of nowhere, nothing beats tomorrow night's special Christmas episode of Fox's Beverly Hills 90210. This series is supposedly grounded in reality, even though it's set in California. And most of the subplots in this week's show do have their serious side. One teenager goes to visit his father in jail, another goes off in search of the mother who gave him up for adoption, and a divorced mom gets jilted on Christmas Eve. But there's this little subplot about a homeless guy who gets tender treatment by the central characters. Brandon Walsh serves him a free meal at the diner. Brenda brings him home for the family feast, and his ratty old Santa bag turns out to have presents for everyone. So who is this guy? Here's how he explains it. Keene Curtis plays Santa.
I wanted to know what happened to the magic of Christmas. I didn't believe it existed anymore. You see, for over 40 years, Mrs. Claus and I lived in a big house high up on the hill. And she made the most wonderful Christmas dinner. We had a big tree with loads of presents for lots of little elves. But the elves grew up and they moved away. Some of them far away and had elves of their own. Santa used to visit them UPS, and Mrs. Claus always made sure they got their gifts on time. And even though it was only she and Santa left in this big house, she still made the most splendid Christmas dinners. But last year, Mrs. Claus died. And as far as I was concerned, Christmas died with her.
That's three Santa sightings in 4 days. And of the three, only the NBC movie pulled it off without seeming cold and manipulative. And when you come off as cold in Beverly Hills, you know you've got a ho-ho-ho bunch of problems. If you want to seek out Santa this season, my advice is to turn off the TV set and watch The Chimney. Or, if you must watch TV for a dose of St. Nick, check out Comedy Central on Saturday. That's when Mystery Science Theater 3000 presents the astoundingly bad 1964 movie Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. It has Santa and UFOs, and even has Pia Zadora as a special bonus. There's no clean sweep because Santa Claus Conquers the Martians doesn't have Elvis. But it comes close. It has elves.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air is produced by Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet one of the greatest songwriting teams in rock and roll history. Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller collaborated on such songs as Kansas City, Hound Dog, Jailhouse Rock, Yakety Yak, Searchin', and Stand By Me. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.